The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Okay, so the title of this talk is To What End? Reclaiming Meaning with Thomas Aquinas. If one hasn't undergone at least three existential crises during their 4 years, one might question whether one has in fact had the college experience. Between paper deadlines, midterms, and finals, the average college student panics over relationships, internship applications, and the reality of getting into medical school. 4 years of high school consisted of watchful hours of one's GPA, packing one's schedule with AP classes, repeating flashcards ad nauseum to pad your SAT score, and disingenuous resume building. And today I still repent over starting my high school chess club in order to boast that I was president. For some lucky students, the rat race and complicit engagement with this Hunger Games dystopia ceased. But for many, this still continues. And under greater anxiety, the undergraduate life with its lab exercises and organic chemistry, which is only matched by the medieval rack for its ability to induce tears from its victims. When one catches a breath during the frenzied activity, a more terrifying question runs up from behind like a boat's wake. Why am I doing all this? Is there any point to it? These pauses between the panic moments of putting out fires, submitting papers, or rushing to the next thing are pregnant pauses with pregnant questions, the kind of questions that thrust you into aimless distractions that might protect you from the critical realization that you don't know what you are doing, don't know what you are living for. T.S. Eliot wrote in Bert Norton about strained, time-ridden faces distracted from distraction by distraction, filled with fancies and empty of meaning. Fancy-filled and yet wearied are those who bounce from one fruitless task to another. The college student who pauses might not simply itch for another shot of dopamine in a pixelated dose. That student might sense that the whole game is shallow and void of meaning. I sometimes joke that Ecclesiastes is my favorite book of scripture. The wearied yet prophetic diagnosis of Koheleth is a sobering reminder that what you ultimately want is not found here. Vanity of vanities, says Koheleth. Vanity of vanities. All things are vanity. That's quite a shocking opening line, which is interpreted in even starker terms by the New International Version's translation, which reads, "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless." Now that sounds like a college student having his second existential crisis after bombing organic chemistry yet again. While the Hebrew word for vanity or meaningless is hebel, meaning breath or puff, the general point holds. This life is full of vain, changing realities that do not last, and the wise preacher Koheleth has searched low and high, far and wide, in order to pronounce this reality. Short of the fullness of revelation that comes in Jesus Christ, the prophet stands perplexed and skeptical, yet with faith still. While it might be a little melodramatic to hold Ecclesiastes as one's favorite book, it can be a stabilizing read for the college student perplexed by his toil. Kohelet studies many paths in life to discover if anything escapes the fleeting change of vanity. He tries pleasure and enjoyment of good things, but this he found wanting. He undertook great works to make a name for himself, to build something that lasts. Nevertheless, he laments, "But when I turn to all the works that my hands had wrought, and to the fruit of the toil for which I had toiled so much, see, all was vanity and a chase after wind. There is no profit under the sun." Even the pursuit of an upright life in accord with wisdom fell into the same category of vanity for Kohelet. Though wisdom has a distinct advantage over folly, he states that the wise man and the fool both meet the same end. In this life, we can recognize that getting enough sleep, studying, and working well with others will bring about a type of prosperity that foolish behavior like drunken carousing, quarreling, and laziness do not. Kohelet doesn't look at the short-term gains. He takes account of the whole of life, and it bewilders him that the wise man and the fool both meet the same end, that is, the grave. Without the light of the resurrection and the promise of eternal life, the preacher of this book of Scripture is right in questioning, what is it all for? The 13th century philosopher and theologian St. Thomas Aquinas also considers the end of human life, but not simply the grave, as the author of Ecclesiastes. In his treatise on happiness, Aquinas begins his treatment of all human action with a consideration as to whether man acts for an end. Unlike animals that act out of instinct, you can imagine birds building nests, beavers building dams, and llamas spitting on zoo visitors, human beings move toward ends or goals. One wakes up in the morning and, after regaining the use of reason, cleans up and begins to plan the day. Questions arise about what classes are today, what social activities, and when exercise can fit into the schedule. Apart from the occasional scratch of the beard or the twirling of hair, human actions are guided by reason and will, which means they are ordered toward some end, some goal. This end or goal of human action gives it meaning. It specifies what the person is doing. If you see someone whittling away at some wood, and you go up and ask, "What are you doing?" you're asking about the meaning of his action. You probably wouldn't simply say, "What is the meaning of this?" Otherwise, you might sound like an elementary school teacher barging in our class who are rambunctious and going around, "What is the meaning of this?" She is still kind of asking about what their actions correspond to, which is nothing less than tomfoolery. To consider the whittling friend once more, if he says to you, "I'm just passing the time," you understand something of his intention. If he says, however, "I'm making chess pieces," you may follow up with another question. Well, why is that? You're searching after a deeper intention, a more remote goal. And the friend may answer, "I'm making a chessboard for my grandfather, whose birthday is coming up." It turns out that the two of them enjoy the same game, and out of love for his grandfather, he wishes to create something that both symbolizes their friendship and enables them to enjoy it together. The whittling grandson helps us to see Aquinas' principle, that it belongs to the human action to act for an end, and this is what ascribes intelligibility and meaning to that activity. There are as many activities in life as there are people, and so it would seem a wearisome task to enumerate all the different kinds of meanings that one's actions could have. When the question of meaning or vanity for Kohelet arises in the human heart, there's a deep sense that there must be one meaning for all of life. Aquinas moves into this consideration, and he articulates that human nature does not simply act toward a multiplicity of ends, it acts for one end. He says so because it's impossible for a series of causes to be ordered indefinitely. You cannot reach a destination if you have several possibilities in mind, or you consider a multiplicity of roads to be taken. When you take a step, you are moving toward a goal and stepping on a concrete particular path. That may seem straightforward, but it is less so with regard to the whole of one's life. Aquinas clarifies that the reality of this matter must be divided into two orders. You have the order of intention and the order of execution. Human acts begin with the order of intention, which is the destination or the goal. This, as I will soon clarify, belongs even to the whole project of one's life, the good that one ultimately seeks. Yet, intentions do not of themselves get results. You can intend to whittle a chessboard for your grandfather, but if you do not act, you do not reach the enjoyment of giving him the gift. The second principle of human action is the order of execution, which is directed toward the end, but it begins with the first step of the journey, or the picking up of the knife to whittle, and all the subsequent actions, the steps, the carving, that follows until the terminus. So to break that down, each human life is directed toward an ultimate end and makes use of means to that end. Each person aims at some final good, or what the good life is, and also makes use of particular means to that end. While it is true that in the course of one's life, a person can switch tracks, so to speak, pursuing one ultimate end at one point and then encounter a profound change of life, it would be incorrect to assert that an individual can at one and the same time pursue multiple ends. A person starting in St. Louis cannot at one and the same time pursue going to San Diego and to New York City. Either one is moving west towards America's finest city, or one is moving toward the east, towards Gotham. Recalling our sections from Ecclesiastes, it's worth noting that the prophet speaks of seeking the life of enjoyment at one time, and then moving on toward a life of great works, and then a life of wisdom. At any given point, his life is marked by the pursuit of an ultimate goal and the activity ordered toward that goal. One way of considering this teleological framework comes from the recently deceased Scottish-American philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, who wrote a seminal work explaining the fragmented state of modern moral ethics. Toward the end of his work, that is, After Virtue, he suggests that one's life is predominantly understood as a quest. A person seeks some idea or ultimate good that defines all the choices and actions one makes over the course of decades. In the final analysis, one has either completed his or her quest or not. Every action has some relation to the quest, or it does not. Even a peaceful morning of surfing at the La Jolla shores ties into the overarching meaning of one's quest, even if one is not attempting to become the most righteous surfer of all time. Simply getting rest and relaxing the mind is an intrinsic step to persevering in your academic pursuits. It's called eutropelia. Look it up. That, of course, presupposes that surf time is properly ordered in not replacing your study time. MacIntyre prefers the language of quest, but Aquinas uses the language of happiness. He believes that not only is an individual human life governed by one ultimate end, he goes even further, stating that all human lives are ordered toward the same end, which is quite shocking when you consider that many people in this world have never been to San Diego or taken up surfing. How is it that he can make this claim when it seems that that human lives are so radically different from one another? It's because he has a proper view of human nature, which is not rooted in experiential relativistic accounts of the good life. He focuses directly on the structure of the human intellect and will, and their proper objects, the true and the good. Citing Augustine, Aquinas states that all humans act for happiness, which is the perfection of one's nature, and not mere emotional contentment. We shouldn't confuse those two. Everyone here is on some quest for happiness. And this becomes more clear when you're subjected to the questioning of a 5-year-old philosopher who incessantly asks, why? You're studying at UC San Diego. Why? Well, you want to get a degree. Why? Well, you want to enter a certain career. Why is that? This particular career is enjoyable and provides a decent salary, insurance, a chance to provide for a family. And why do you want to do that? Well, I suppose it will make me happy, you might say. The child might ask once more, well, why do you want to be happy? And that's the point when you escort the child out of the room. Right? That is the point, right? We ultimately are seeking happiness. It's what everyone is seeking. Aquinas states that although everyone agrees that happiness is the end of human activity, not everyone is in agreement about the things necessary for happiness. Even in the example above, not everyone in this life agrees that marriage and family constitutes the perfection of human life. Some throw themselves into a life of promiscuity, while others voluntarily choose celibacy. Some believe wealth constitutes happiness, while others seek power or honor or some other thing. So there are competing opinions as to what the good life consists of having or what quests human beings should pursue. Recognizing this difference, Aquinas cites a curious example to explain how we ought to know the best means to the end. He states, to everyone, the taste of sweet is pleasant. But to some, the sweetness of wine is most pleasant. To others, the sweetness of honey, or of something similar. Yet that sweet is absolutely the best of all pleasant things, in which he who has the best taste takes most pleasure. In like manner, that good is most complete, which the man with well-disposed affections desires for his last end. This may seem like a big leap, but we recognize that people exist in society that offer insights about the quality of food or wine. A sommelier is best able to test and judge the quality of wine, more so than the typical person. This was a hard lesson for my classmates in college. They took a wine tasting class thinking they would have a good time, and it turned out that their tongues were rubbish and they failed. They weren't able to develop their taste in accord with the expert. Aquinas suggests that there exists within humanity the sommelier of right living, of the virtuous person who has well-disposed affections for the last end. If we don't follow after that virtuous person's example, we will fail in our quest for happiness, much like my classmates in the wine tasting class. Thankfully, Aquinas does not leave us in suspense with regard to the various avatars of happiness. In the next question of his treatise, he begins to assess 8 options, all of which fail to truly provide the perfection of happiness. When we ask what end, we definitively can say that it is not wealth, honor, glory, power, the good of the body, pleasure, the good of the soul, or any created good. Let's take each in turn. Many college students have dollar signs in their eyes while stepping on campus. Social engagements, majors, and internship opportunities become about one thing, accruing wealth. This, however, is a fool's errand, which won't lead to true and lasting happiness. The first reason is that wealth is best spent, and therefore simply having it suggests a further action. You need to consider how the money ought to be used, which indicates that there is some further good to be obtained. Notice that Aquinas does not condemn wealth, but simply says it doesn't constitute the perfection of human nature. Next, we can consider honor. which occupies the heart of many students who long to get that perfect score on the test, win the game, or be seen as the best among their peers. Honor, however, has the dynamic of residing in the one who honors, rather than in the one who is honored. Additionally, honor follows after some excellence that one possesses. As Aquinas says, happiness can result in honor, but happiness cannot principally consist in honor. There is also the reality that not everything that is honorable is honored in one. For one, given over to vice might be honored by a select group of people sharing that depraved vision of human excellence. Therefore, we don't simply desire honor itself, but to be honored on account of what is truly good, perfect, and noble. Third, we consider the avatar of fame or glory, those with star-studded dreams, false reports, fickle fans, and the general lack of human awareness makes such dreams futile. The wise saying of Solon, "Call no man happy until he is dead," hedges against this capricious reality. Fame and glory as it pertains to the populace can change and is often untethered to the true and real. Aquinas does, however, make reference to the fame and glory that comes from God, which is constitutive of one's happiness. For man's good is caused by God's knowledge, and so there is a direct relationship between man's beatitude and the glory man has with God. Another consideration of this comes from St. Irenaeus of Lyon's famous passage, "The glory of God is man living, and the life of man is the vision of God." He's speaking of beatitude, which we'll get into in just a few minutes. Aquinas next turns his attention to the pursuit of power, which is a path many politicians or tech giants seek. In his authoritative argument in the Sed Contra, Aquinas cites Boethius's On the Consolation of Philosophy. This work was written in the 6th century while the author was in prison and awaiting execution, and it provides a series of reflections on life and the pursuit of happiness that is only accessible to the wisest of men. Boethius states that power cannot ultimately perfect one because it leaves one with anxiety about how to use the power, and often one with power is most afraid of those that seek to take it away. Aquinas goes further, stating that power is merely a principle, whereas happiness is an end. With power, one is only beginning to pursue the good, but one who is happy already has finished the race. Our goal is not to be found in potentially arriving at happiness, but in possessing it in actuality. The fifth end for consideration is the good of the body, but this is unlikely in part because of death. There's also the reality that the body is for the good of the soul, serves a higher purpose. We won't dwell long on this topic because we won't dwell long in mortal flesh. Perhaps one of the most popular goals of a college student is the life of pleasure. Referring to Boethius's insights from prison, Aquinas reminds one that past excesses in pleasure led to sad results. Many students can attest to this on Saturday morning. The hangover is just one example, but there are other examples of lives wrecked because virtuous living was substituted with living for bodily pleasure. In addition to that sad reality, there is a more metaphysical reality that delight falls after the possession of a good in the manner that proper accidents follow upon some principle of an essence. So the classic example for this is how humans have the ability to laugh. That is, they possess the property of risibility because of the rationality of the essence. We are human because we are rational as opposed to risible. Delight has a similar relationship to the essence of happiness. Delight is consequent to the possession of a good. it arises out of it, whether it's a good of the body or a good of the soul. As a result, delight cannot be the final end in which one finds happiness. There must be some good that gives rise to the delight. Next, we consider whether the good of one's soul constitutes happiness. And again, we see it's a dead end. This is rather helpful for those trapped in perfectionism. The attainment of some good outside of oneself constitutes happiness. And the pursuit and possession of this contains a sort of disinterestedness. Viktor Frankl touches on a similar thought in Man's Search for Meaning, a book comprised of his philosophical and psychological insights during his three-year imprisonment in Nazi concentration camps. He states, "I think that even the saints did not care for anything other than simply to serve God, and I doubt that they ever had it in mind to become saints. If that were the case, they would have become only perfectionists rather than saints." The indication here is that the saints, those that obtain beatitude, are fully fixed on the possession of God and not the good of their soul. We come to the last and most general avatar for happiness, whether it is any created good. No created good has the power and limitlessness to satiate all the appetites in the human person. The human will cannot be satisfied except by the universal good, and the human intellect cannot be satisfied except by the universal true. All creatures merely participate in the goodness of God, and as such remain finite and limited. Only God is goodness without limit or qualification, and is therefore the universal good that man's will seeks happiness in. The virtuous person, the sommelier guide for our quest, does not seek any of these avatars of happiness. There is a higher good to which the virtuous takes the most delight in, the good in which happiness is found. After establishing that the perfection of human nature, happiness or beatitude, is only found in God as the universal good, Aquinas begins a discussion about how this happiness exists in the human person. He ultimately states that the uncreated cause of happiness, God, becomes a created reality in the human person. And this is through the actualization of the intellect, the highest part of the human soul, its proper operation. And so here it's important to understand the two acts that belong to human nature. Our lives consist of the act of existence, what is called the first act, and the life of operation, which is called the second act. This distinction is easy to see when we consider the reality that we exist, whether we sleep, eat, talk, or think. These various activities presuppose an act of existence, but we aren't truly human unless further operations are engaged. We don't exist as inert objects like rocks, or beings guided by instincts like animals. We exist as rational animals that have the freedom to know and love. So the created perfection within the human person consists of actively knowing and loving God by means of divine assistance. While discussing whether happiness is an operation, Aquinas raises an important objection that states, "Happiness remains in the happy one." Now, operation does not remain, but passes. Therefore, happiness is not an operation. So we should see the force of this objection because we're often flitting about like squirrels in this life, moving from one panicked activity to another. One need not have ADHD and an unhealthy attachment to brain rot to recognize human operation suffers from change, interruption, and cessation. In responding to this objection, Aquinas offers important distinctions that help us to see differing degrees of perfection within happiness. First, there is the happiness of God, who enjoys happiness by his essence. There is no coming to be or ceasing to be in God. He simply is and will always and forever be perfectly happy. Angels have their degree by which, in a singular choice aided by grace, they share in the divine happiness. We, however, have a long life of many choices influenced by circumstances that nevertheless remain our operation. Given the complexity of human life, perfect happiness is not possible while we are in our mortal body. We occupy the status of homo viator, pilgrims on the way, who have no lasting happiness on this side of death. Quoting Aristotle, Aquinas writes, "We call men happy, but only as men." Which is to say, those who obtain happiness in this life have it imperfectly and temporarily. The objection holds true, but only for the imperfect happiness in this life, which is a participation of perfect happiness. I've already made reference to Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning earlier in this lecture, and I'd like to return for a moment to his text and to a particular part that illustrates very well the power of achieving imperfect happiness. Within his reflection, I believe we can see a glimpse of what is contained within the perfect happiness of contemplating God. Writing of his suffering during 3 years in the Nazi prison camps, those of Auschwitz and others, Viktor Frankl describes the intense spiritual insight he gained while contemplating his love for his wife. Upon an early morning march, buffeted by icy winds and cruel attacks from the guards, while supporting himself on the frail arm of his fellow prisoner, Frankl thought of his wife. He writes, "For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers, the truth that love is the ultimate and the highest goal to which a man can aspire. Then I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world still may know bliss, be it only for a brief moment, in the contemplation of his beloved. In a position of utter desolation, when man cannot express himself in positive action, when his only achievement may consist in enduring his sufferings in the right way, an honorable way, in such a position man can, through loving contemplation of the image he carries of his beloved, achieve fulfillment. For the first time in my life, I was able to understand the meaning of the words, the angels are lost in perpetual contemplation of an infinite glory." Frankl's account and insights ultimately point to his logotherapy, a school of psychology that seeks to find an ultimate reason for one's actions and living, often in the context of suffering and disillusionment. His reflections upon the love he carried for his wife truly assisted him in survival. There's something undoubtedly inspiring and desirable in the triumph of his contemplation of love. Within this powerful and touching scene, Frankl mentions a brief enjoyment of bliss, even while enduring the most dreadful and painful conditions. While there is a sense in which one could say he is contemplating a created reality, he clarifies elsewhere that, quote, "love goes far beyond the physical person of the beloved. It finds its deepest meaning in his spiritual being, his inner self," end quote. In his darkest days, with so much of life deprived of him, Frankl contemplated a love that went beyond the mere person of his wife, a love that beckoned him to live. Aquinas states that contemplation is delightful because one gazes upon that which he loves. It's a correspondence similar to seeing a person you love. The contemplative life, then, which is most directly ordered toward perfect happiness, consists of chiefly contemplating God according to charity. The powerful description of Frankl's interior life during his harrowing survival closely parallels the contemplation of a saint, whereas in the later example, the object of contemplation is God himself. While direct vision cannot happen, one can nevertheless delight in contemplating the mystery of God's love amidst all the suffering of this life. When describing the true, final, and perfect end of man, Aquinas argues that only the vision of God's essence will suffice. In part, all of us who encounter an effect, that is, anything in reality, are struck with wonder, gazing out upon the beauty, vastness, or truth of creation, leads us to ponder about its origins, the reason for its existence. Some of you may experience this desire while gazing out upon the beautiful horizon of the Pacific, or the afternoon sun raking across the Laguna Mountains. Still others may find the desire to know further the complexities of the law of physics, the biological structures of life, or some other science of reality that is, in truth, a divine effect. Sometimes this wonder turns to ourselves and is coupled with a type of dread or anxiety because we realize that we are not sufficient to explain ourselves. Were that the case, happiness would have simply been the good of our own body or soul, and not, as Aquinas articulates, in the operation of the highest part of our soul. Our intellect requires some object outside of itself to contemplate in order to be satiated and perfected, to be truly and perfectly happy. The object we long to contemplate resolves the aporia we experience in the wonder described above. We long to know the origin, cause, and reason for all that exists. We see the effects of God's causation in all of creation, and we are not at rest or truly happy until we know that cause, that is, the essence of God. The Baltimore Catechism famously states that the meaning of life is to know, love, and serve God in this life, and to be with him for eternity in the next. There is a simplicity to the statement that seems to cut through much of the fog that complicates our lives. So often, this general principle is put to the side amidst the competing ends of our happiness, the avatars that Aquinas rules out in his arguments. Whether one is living for the true end of the beatific vision or some other lesser good gives shape to the meaning of his or her life. One may be seeking honor by pursuing some excellence in a career, and the meaning of one's actions and efforts speaks to that. It is as though one is whittling away, and you were to ask, "What are you doing?" That person would respond, "I am seeking honor through this." Perhaps the efforts are going well, and one is seemingly obtaining the goal. One's grades are excellent. One has earned the best internship. Perhaps even landed the job. One's quest and the meaning associated with the quest would seem to be intact, but only for a time. Hearkening back to Koheleth, who pursued the life of great works, he ultimately saw vanity in it all. The fruit of his toil, that is, his active life, could not ultimately satisfy him. Aquinas would argue differently, saying that the honor one obtains through excellence in some field is fragile, and ultimately resides in the one honoring rather than in the one who is honored. Perhaps it is a virtue one seeks, but this cannot endure in this life. The quest is set up to fail, and the means to that end are a fruitless task. Whittling away for this quest is ultimately meaningless because it seeks an end that does not truly provide happiness. Viktor Frankl explains that there are situations, the most tragic even, that actually benefit the person in finding the deeper meaning of life. While he attended to patients in Auschwitz, he entered into a profound conversation. A young woman knew that she would die in the next few days. But when I talked to her, she was cheerful in spite of this knowledge. "I am grateful that fate has hit me so hard," she told me. "In my former life, I was spoiled and did not take spiritual accomplishments seriously." Pointing through the window of the hut, she said, "This tree here is the only friend I have in my loneliness." Through that window, she could see just one branch of a chestnut tree, and on the branch were two blossoms. "I often talk to this tree," she said to me. I was startled and didn't quite know how to take her words. Was she delirious? Did she have occasional hallucinations? Anxiously, I asked her if the tree replied. "Yes." "What did it say to her?" She answered, "It said to me, 'I am here. I am here. I am life, eternal life.'" This woman was far from delirious. She was piercing through the vain shadows of life, seeing into the promises of God. Should one be touched by faith in hearing these words, does it not sound like the voice of the Good Shepherd? She speaks to an outstretched arm of a tree that bears blossoms, all the while promising eternal life. Those with eyes of faith can sense that the one who outstretched his arms upon the cross, transforming dead wood into the tree of life, is the one who beckons to this woman who is willing now to leave all things behind. She, like many saints, we hope, found meaning in her suffering. Not as though the evil of her torture and imprisonment, the loss of her family, was good in itself, but her response to it redirected her life to what is spiritual and lasting. She only had God, and that was all she needed. Within his writing, Viktor Frankl often cites a maxim of Friedrich Nietzsche: "He who has a why to live for can bear with almost any how." The indication, of course, is that man's ultimate motivating force is meaning. Within the context of his prison camp, Frankl observed men who lost sight of meaning and sadly passed, no longer having the motivation needed to survive. The life of enjoyment that Koheleth mentions at the start of Ecclesiastes was not available to these men, or as Aquinas would say, the goods of the body, pleasure, honor, power, were all taken away. Likewise, the active life to pursue one's own goals or dreams was left in the past, and instead the prisoners were forced into slave labor. Frankl, a revered psychiatrist, was reduced to picking and digging through frozen earth. This is the stripping away of the life of great works that Koheleth mentions. But there were those that still lived the life of wisdom, rising above the despairing circumstances. Frankl writes, "But there is also purpose in that life which is almost barren of both creation and enjoyment, and which admits of but one possibility of high moral behavior, namely in a man's attitude to his existence, an existence restricted by external forces. The way in which a man accepts his fate and all the suffering it entails, the way in which he takes up his cross, gives him ample opportunity, even under the most difficult circumstances, to add a deeper meaning to his life. We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." All the circumstances of life, whether extreme ones like those of Frankl's life or the quotidian circumstances of our own lives, offer us an opportunity to order our thoughts, attitudes, and activities toward a true and noble end, or not. When Aquinas mentions the requirements for happiness, he mentions that one needs rectitude of the will, which is nothing less than our will's ordering and longing for the vision of God. While none of us can bring it about by our own powers, we need God's grace. God in his wisdom ordains that we cooperate in the circumstances of our day. No matter our academic careers, our high hopes for this life, whatever goods we accrue or delights we enjoy, none of it of itself brings about a true and lasting meaning. It can, however, when one offers them up in praise to God, to the service of one's neighbor, or freely renounces them in order that one's heart may be fixed on what is above, it accrues meaning. At each moment of our life, whenever we turn to consider and desire our final end, that is God himself, we are reclaiming the why of our life and preparing to suffer anyhow. We reclaim meaning with each meritorious act of charity that orders our complex set of desires to God. With our vision fixed upon the end, each step of our journey has meaning, for we are one step closer to happiness. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.